Welcome to the Friends of McGill Hockey Podcast. This is Ken Tyler, your host of the Captain's Meeting. Today, we're going to be meeting with three former Redmond captains who have experienced the ultimate in the hockey world. They have all raised the Stanley Cup in victory. The latest three of 16 Redmond in this exclusive group to have had their names engraved on the trophy forever. Our captains that we're going to be meeting today are Mathieu Darche, McGill captain in 1999-2000. Jamie Compan, McGill captain in 1988-89, and Mike Babcock, McGill captain in 1986-87. What a special group we've got here. We've got a superstition that you shouldn't touch the cup unless you've won it. And we have three gentlemen on this call who are all former McGill Redmen and the three living McGill Redmen who have had that opportunity. And I absolutely want to take to hear how it was for you. So Matt, you're the most recent. 2020 was your year. Jamie, you raised the cup in 2012 and 2013. And Mike, you raised it in 2008. And I'm sure each and every one of you want to do it again, but we know how difficult that is to do. To start with, the feeling that you had to have had, it had to be an amazing feeling. When was the moment that you came to knew you were going to win the cup, and how did you feel?
Well, for me, I didn't experience it as a player, which would have been awesome. I just made this move to Tampa, and it was different this year. Let's face it, we're in a bubble. There's no fans. But it's funny because once the game started, we didn't even know there was no fans. I mean, the players were saying, like, the players were telling us that besides a TV timeout the first few games, you know, once the puck drops, you're playing. Our coaches, once the puck drops, they're playing, you know, they're managing the bench. But the feeling to finally have it, and for me to move to Tampa like I did last summer with a 14 and 16-year-old boy, middle of high school, was a big deal for the family. You know, I know the boys sacrificed a lot. Am I fortunate in my first year in management to win it? Of course, but I came in a pretty good situation. I didn't go in a rebuild. I came in with a team that won 62 games the year before. So, but the feeling of it, and I still remember FaceTiming when we're all around Gary Bettman on the ice when he's giving us the trophy because the whole team went around the cup. I'm FaceTiming with my kids, and it was a pretty special moment. It almost felt like the move was all worth it, you know. And the only reason I was able to make this move because my wife and my kids accepted to do it. I mean, Jamie and Mike will attest to that. I mean, it's tougher on the family than on us, like, to move around. So it was an unbelievable feeling. It's something, I mean, I keep reading from Earl Zuckerman when Jamie won and when Mike won and when Mike won the gold medal in the Olympics. So, you know, you read about these guys all the time, and now it's your turn. So it was an unbelievable feeling. And now you want more.
And then you raise the cup above your head. The Ted Lindsay move, huh? How was it?
Yeah. It was awesome. I mean, it's like I said, it's funny because even when we raised the cup, you'd think, with fans, it's so much better because they're screaming, but we weren't even thinking about it. And what some of the guys that have been around, like even Pat Maroon that won last year, they said the good thing about being in the bubble is when we got back to dressing rooms, it was us.
Yeah.
It was the team, the coaches, the management. That's it. So it was actually, you know, we were sitting in a coach's office. Guys were walking in and out. Like Nikita Kucherov, who doesn't talk very much, came and sat for half an hour talking to us, which you're like, wow, you know. So it was those moments were special because it was only you in the dressing room. So you wish you could have shared it with your family, of course, and the fans, but it made it special in a certain way also.
Got a favorite celebration story?
Oh, boy, the Pat Maroon, a.k.a. Big Rig, he's a beauty. I mean, you should see the number of people on social media in Tampa that dress like him at the parade with no shirt on, scarf, the crooked hat. Like, you know, it's to win a cup, it's guys like that. Patty was on our fourth line. He made our guys a bit braver on the ice. I mean, his first two games against Boston during the season, he fought Zdeno Chara. That's the last guy I'd want to fight in the league. And he's a funny guy. He's the social guy in the room. Guys like him and Kevin Schattinger, you need those guys. Yeah, everybody knows we won because of Hedman, Kucherov, Braden Point. But you need those glue guys also that come in and make a big difference. Pat Maroon was one of the good ones. And Kucherov was pretty funny too.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Babs, over to you. You've had a longer journey to get to that cup, and you sniffed at it a few times before and definitely afterwards.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously, Darche, you know, to be on the call with you guys, to be McGill Redmen, the decision when I went to McGill changed my life forever for the better. And, you know, my best friends in the world, the same six of us have been hanging together for 37 years and our wives for 27 years. It's a phenomenal thing to be part of this family. And then to see you guys have success and to raise the cup is a special thing. you know, from an individual point of view, I'd been to the Cup final my first year in the league, lost in game 7. And, you know, I had Steve Thomas there, I had Adam Oates there, guys who had been in the league forever and knew their careers were coming to an end. And to see their disappointment in losing game 7, Pat Burns was coaching New Jersey, and I watched them lift the cup. I wanted to see what it was like. And obviously it was gut-wrenching, but I hadn't earned the opportunity by only being in the National Hockey League 1 year, in my opinion, to raise the cup at that time. I was fortunate enough to get an opportunity to coach in Detroit. And the year before we won, I felt that I had a chance 4 times. So the only time you have a chance to win the cup, in my opinion, is when you won 15 games. You got to win the 16th game, won 15 games 3 times, only won 16 games once. But the year before we won the cup in Detroit, in 07, we had a hell of a team. You know, we lost to Anaheim, they won, but thought we had a chance. By the time 08 came around, you knew you had a real opportunity. You knew our guys were hungry, and no different than Tampa. We had had some setbacks. We had good teams with chances to win. We had had some setbacks. We had the battle scars from losing. And so when you get into it and you get the rhythm going, you can feel it. But your question is, what's it feel like to win the Stanley Cup? Well, some things that stand out in my mind, Kenny, is different than what Darcy went through is, we won it in Pittsburgh. Your family's there. Your family's on the ice with you. Mm-hmm. They've sacrificed. Richard talked about his kids. So many things. My wife, my daughter says her first 5 years of school, she was in a different school. She didn't know the kids. We moved so much. My family moved so much for their sacrifices, for them to get to share it with you. The other thing that resonates in my mind is your family name goes on that thing, and it's going to be on there till you die. So your dad's name's on the Stanley Cup. Pretty cool. And then the last thing you talked about is the opportunity to lift that cup over your head. You've seen so many people do it before you. You're on the ice. You're so thrilled to death. It's been such a battle to get there. You feel so fortunate. And for you to see your players do it and then for you to get a chance to put it above your head is something you'll never, ever forget. And that picture you have, it's somewhere in your house. You're going to have it forever. And so it was a special time to share with family. Enjoyed it a lot. And it was great to see these guys do the same.
Absolutely. And your favorite story about celebrating?
You know, I was real lucky. The cup came home to Saskatchewan. I had a good day right in the city of Saskatoon, took it to the hospital and then had people come by. And then I got it out at my lake place, put it on the boathouse, and anybody who wanted could come by. I had told my wife a few years earlier, there's a kid who used to bagpipe around the lake on Saturday nights with his grandpa. And I told my wife a couple of years before we won, I said, when we win, he'll be bagpiping us around. And he did. We had every pontoon boat you can imagine on that lake and a big parade around the lake. That was a special thing and one of the things I always remember.
Very nice. Thank you. Comper, over to you, man.
I'm in a little different situation because I was fortunate enough to win it with a team that I don't think anyone expected us to win. When I got to LA after 9 years in St. Louis, we had such good teams in St. Louis. And I think Babs can attest to it. Our teams were, we had depth, we had defense, we had one missing ingredient and we could never get over the hump. And plus, you know, you had good Dallas teams, you had great Detroit teams, and the depth within the division to get out of the division. And then getting to LA in the first 2 years, just being in a total rebuild and not understanding Dean's, I don't want to say not understanding, but trying to find a direction on which way we were going with the team. And after 6 years and a couple coaching changes, I was fortunate to make it through. And the adversity that we had faced throughout the year, and getting into the last week of the playoffs and winning the last two of our last 3 games to get in the playoffs as the 8th seed, and then just building momentum. And we made some trades at the deadline. We brought in Jeff Carter, and we brought in, you know, I think Jeff Carter was a big addition for us. Mike Richards earlier in the year, in the offseason. So those players were huge. And then the addition of Jarrett Stoll and Matt Green, they really solidified that depth that you talk about, your Pat Maroons and your Kevin Shattenkirks. Those guys, you need those glue guys on the team. You need those voices. You need that little bit of enlightenment. Greener is a funny guy, and he was a huge part of what we did. But just the way we went about our business. Daryl came in and he's no nonsense. This is what he expected. This is how we had to do things. Our path was, we got up every series 3-0. Every series. I don't think it, you know, with no disrespect to the league, I don't know if there's going to be any team that's going to be able to do that again. And we were started on the road. So we won 3 in a row to start every series. We beat Vancouver in 5. We beat St. Louis in 4. We beat Phoenix in 4 or 5, I should say. And then going in against New Jersey and taking them to 6. And winning was unbelievable. And the day of the game was a Monday, and it was June 11th. I'll never forget. And I never thought anything of it. My wife, we stayed in the hotel the night before. We have our video. We have our meeting the night before, everything like that. We're playing at home, and my wife calls, and she goes, "How you doing today?" I go, "Good, good." And she kept on prodding me about something, and I never quite understood it. And it finally clicked in after the game was over, and we had won the cup. It was our anniversary. So that was our anniversary present. And I totally was just, and you know how it is when you're in that zone, you're just, and you're not in the twilight zone. You're in a zone where you're totally focused on the task at hand. And she called me about 2 or 3 times during the day, and I never clued in once. And she wasn't going to succumb to saying, "Okay, well, happy anniversary, dear. You forgot," sort Good of thing. Her. But when it was all said and done, when I saw her after the game, that was our most memorable anniversary present ever. But it was something to remember. And I think the biggest thing that we won that game, it started early. We got a power play. We scored 3 power play goals. We're up 4-1. And like Matthew said, though, anything can happen. And, you know, we're cruising right along in the third period, and we scored 2 late goals, and the bench is going crazy. And, you know, Daryl's a pretty no-nonsense guy, and he wanted to make sure that we were on task and everyone was on task. And I don't think until the last minute is my body was numb. And I just watching those young players that we had on our team, some of the kids that we mentored throughout the way, just celebrating it.
Had to be satisfying.
The exuberance that we saw with them was unbelievable. And then just the staff.
So come on. Who'd you get the cup from? And then you lifted it up.
I got the cup from John Stevens, and Bill Ranford came over to me, and he had won twice before, and he just patted my chest, and he goes, "Now you know what it feels like." And that to me, and he's one of my best friends, and it was an unbelievable embrace that when I gave him the cup, it was phenomenal. So, and I was fortunate enough to win it again in Chicago the following year, a little different circumstances for Joel to have enough confidence in me to hire me on in Chicago. And he was the first one that hired me in the NHL. And then to win with him and Mike Kitchen, who are real close friends of mine,
had to be very satisfying.
Was a phenomenal.
Your favorite in either city, your favorite celebration story?
My dad wasn't able to make it to the first one. He was sick. So bringing the cup to him in the second time we won, bringing the cup to him and having him celebrate and having him see the cup and spend the day with the cup was very, very special to me.
See, that's what's different this year too. Like, I don't think the cup will have its usual tour, because obviously with the travel restrictions. So I'm probably going to have either this coming Saturday or the 16th, my day with the cup, but in Tampa. We'll invite a few friends over. But even if I go back to Montreal, quarantine for 2 weeks, you can't even have one person over right now with the rules in Quebec. So it's unfortunate, but hey, we live in a global pandemic. You got to deal with it.
Yeah, Kenny, I was just going to say here is that thing to share with your family, comforting about his dad and the pandemic and what's going on right now. When you get to take the Stanley Cup, much different than an Olympic gold medal, when you get to take the Stanley Cup back to your town to say thanks to all the people that helped you along the way and to watch them talk about it, they fight over which is the best team of all time, the best player. They're looking at all the names. You got the old guys that are around for the original 6. It's incredible to share that with your community, because those are the people that helped you get to where you wanted to go and to give you this opportunity. So it's a special thing. So, Darsher, I hope you get to enjoy that.
I hope so eventually too. Absolutely. Or you just have to win another one.
He says after his first year, insights on the journey. I mean, it hit me when you said been there 3 times at 15 wins, Mike and Comper, you talking about the 6 years to get to that potential. And that was a dark horse team that won, getting in the last couple of games. Mathieu, we won't necessarily talk about your experience with respect to the Lightning, but you certainly have had a long journey to get yourself to where you are right now. And I wanted to ask you about that. What are the insights on the journey that you've had so far? I mean, there's been so many teams you've come up short. What are the critical elements that have made the difference on the championship year? That's one piece, and you take it where you want to take it. Is it culture? Is it strategy? Is it people? What's the formula? What comes first? And then the other thing, which you've all mentioned a little bit of, not all of you, but what was the actual turning point for that winning year or years in your case, Comper?
Okay. Well, listen, as a player, the furthest I've been is conference final, which was great. And living in Montreal, being in my hometown, was an unbelievable feeling. But to, like I said, and I retired, worked in the business world and got this opportunity to come. You know, the determining factor this year of winning the cup, it's because it's not about me. Like, I'm not the one playing. Now we make deals, but at the end of the day, it's the players first. Yeah. They're the ones playing. And everybody knows what happened to the Lightning last year, winning 62 games, losing in four to Columbus. I think the best thing that happened to us was starting against Columbus, because the way Columbus plays, it forces you to play the right way. Because if you try, like, the, you know, they backtrack hard. They play hard on you. And, you know, when I said you have to be good, you have to be lucky, is it can switch like this in the playoffs. What if the first game against Columbus, we played an outstanding game. The scoring chances, it was 5 overtime, mind you. It was a long game. It was 40-20 for us. They had 20 scoring chances in 8 periods, which is, I mean, Comper and Babs will say, like, that's a pretty good defensive effort. But if we lose that game, that first game, are you questioning yourself again, what the hell are we going to have to do to beat that team? So I think it could have been deflating. I trust the character of our guys, but you don't know how guys react to that, especially with what happened the year before. Then you go to the second round, we lose game one, fine. Second game, we go to overtime, we win it. If we lose that one, does it change? So winning, to me, is on the edge. You have to be good. If you're not good, you can't win. But in my opinion, you have to have some bounces, some luck. And for those of you that watched their round robin game when against Philadelphia, when Victor Hedman went down, that night we thought he was out 4 to 6 weeks. That changes your team. When it's your D, it's like, you know, Doughty in L.A. and Nick Lidstrom in Detroit. You lose those guys, it affects your team. So to me, starting, like, all these little things, but starting against Columbus for us was the big slay the dragon. You know, what happened the year before? They had some swag. Maybe our guys were hesitant. I think our coaches did a great job preparing our guys. And winning that first game and winning that series, because Mike said it at the start, we were known to, you know, like to play the cute game. And it forced us to play the right way. Then when we won in 5, it kind of shows the players. Coaches can say, you see, you play like that, you win. So I think that was a turning point for us this year.
Good stuff. And your personal learning, I know you've got a different role. You're not front and center, but you're a big part of the organization. What's your personal takeaway in terms of what it took for you to help this organization win, to be a part of this organization winning, and what you go forward to try and make the repeat?
Well, it's not only having the best players, it's having a good mix of players, because we had as much talent as anybody can find. I think we're one of the most talented teams in the league, but like we said, we started in the summer, like, not to be afraid to make tweaks. And even I've learned a lot from Julien Brisebois in 1 year. Like, he's an outstanding GM. The way he thinks about he didn't play the game, but trust me, he's an unbelievable hockey mind. He spent 10 years with Bob Gainey and 8 with Steve Yzerman. 2 pretty good guys to learn from. Yeah. And, you know, we started, like, Pat Maroon's a slow skater, but he's one of the first guys we signed in the summer. He changed our identity a bit. Then we brought Kevin Shattenkirk on a good deal. Then at the deadline, Barclay Goodrow, I mean, Comper, you've coached against him this year too. He's not the guy that's going to get you 50 points. But he kills penalties, he hits, he plays the right way, he's on the right side of the puck. So all these guys, we had enough talent. We don't need to win 6-0. We have to learn to be able to win those 2-1 games. So to not be able to make moves, you know, like, not reckless, but we're at that point, we needed to make a few changes, and it worked out for us.
The toughest decision changes effectively.
Yeah, we gave 2 first-round picks at the deadline.
To watch the process from the outside, and you see a team losing the first round, you see management stay steady, you see all the players go away, they come back, you watch what the management does to help the players help themselves by adjusting the team. The line you started each night set the tone on the forecheck. 2 of the 3 guys weren't even there. To add the depth you added, to me, that's what it's about, is the negative. It took Michael Jordan 7 years to win a championship, guys. It's part of the losing. It's part of the setbacks. None of us want any duress in our life. We don't want things to be going bad, but it's what makes you better. It what makes you a champion is you learn through the adversity. You learn how to overcome it. You learn how to stick to it. And what I like about the game of hockey the best is if you don't play it right, you cannot win. If you do not play it right, you cannot win. If the players aren't all in, if the management isn't all in, if there's any cracks in what you're doing, you're not going to win. That's why the trophy is so special. And that's why it feels so great when you finally do it. And so to me, to watch from the outside, it was special to watch, to say the least.
Thanks, Thank Mike. Comper, over to you, man.
Just following up with Babs, I agree. Like, you look at, I mentioned bringing Jeff Carter in. Our management, like with Dean Lombardi, you can say what you want about Dean, but he's got a vision. He's almost like a mad scientist. He understands where he needs to go and what he needs to get and what we need to get. We went out and got Jeff Carter because we lacked scoring, but we gave up Jack Johnson in the first round. Everyone was Jack Johnson. But we knew we had Slava Voynov in the minors, who was a right-handed defenseman who complemented Willie Mitchell, who we had for a stint for 10 games. So we knew what we had. So we actually got Jeff Carter and Slava Voynov in our lineup. And to add the pieces that we did, getting Mike Richards, yeah, it cost us Braden Schenn and Wayne Simmonds, but we needed a Mike Richards. We needed that pedigree of a Mike Richards who's been there. Adding Justin Williams, all those little pieces that, like Babs talked about, and the Jarrett Stolls and the Matt Greens, those are the glue guys that you need. You hear those guys in the locker room. Those are the leaders you hear in the locker room that make it light, that talk and that play the right way. And then just making sure that they hold each other accountable. Like, that was the one thing that I thought that our team did well in LA was, it was just a shift by shift attitude. We went out, we played our shift. Mm. We let the cards fall where they may. We played the game the right way, each shift, in game in and game out. For the most part, you're going to come out on the right side of the ledger. And that's what we did to park the game. Like, we never got overconfident or anything like that in terms of where we were at. When the game was over, we parked it. It was over midnight. Then you started thinking about what we needed to do next game. And we went through the video. We talked about it. We addressed what we needed to do. And we made sure that we played to our identity each and every night. And a credit to Daryl Sutter for keeping us on task, but a credit to Dean Lombardi to go out and make those bold moves like you talk about, like Julien Brisebois did. And in your case, Mike, like Ken Holland went and did. You know, it's the same thing. It's everybody on the same page, pulling from the same end of the rope. And then your players seeing that, and then your players believing it. Once your players start believing it, hey, the sky's the limit. It just snowballs, and it's a snowball effect. And that's the way it was definitely in L.A.
Kenny, I want to jump in one more time here, just along these lines. You know, Kenny Holland, Hall of Fame general manager and all that, and the moves he made, we would have never won without Rafalski. But in saying that, there was a guy that we added named Dallas Drake. And Dallas Drake had been through all the losing in St. Louis. They'd win the President's Trophy. They couldn't keep it out of their net at playoff time. He had been there, been the captain. He had gone through it. When he came to Detroit, and he was an unbelievable forechecker. He scared the shit out of the other team's D. And we'd play him a lot early in the games, and he'd go out there and run around. But his veteran leadership in the room, his calmness, heck, he used to meet the coach for coffee. He'd be the first guy in the morning, he'd probably calm the coach down, straighten the coach out. Hey, what a difference that man made, how he could settle young guys down, how if it wasn't going your way, he could help you out. It's those little moves that the manager makes that makes the rest of you look good in the end.
Was it the GOAT or was it the captain's class? If you guys know that book, was it the GOAT, the greatest of all time that you had on your team that won that? Or was it somebody that level five leader from the Jim Collins book, from going from good to great, the guy in the boiler room that nobody really knows about, but he's the one who makes everything tick, that you mentioned about the Drake situation, whatnot. Who was it? Did you have a GOAT? Who was your captain's class? Who was that guy? You know, not every team has a Jordan that is the GOAT and also the captain's class boiler room leader. What did you have? And it doesn't necessarily always have to be a player, because you're also referring to that too. I'll start with Comper. Yeah.
Yeah. I know Mike was on our, and Liam also, earlier this yeah. summer, we did the Friends of McGill Hockey Coaches Clinic. And the one guy that sticks out for me, and I coached him three times in St. Louis as a rookie. In LA, we brought him in. And then in Chicago, we brought him in at the deadline, was Michael Hamsis. The impact Michael Hamsis had on Anze Kopitar was absolutely incredible. He took this young kid from Slovenia and taught him what it was to be a pro every day, bringing him in the gym, teaching him about routine, teaching him about practice habits. And Kopi was just a young kid at the time. And, you know, Michael was coming off ACL injury, and his mentorship to Anze Kopitar, I think to this day, Kopi will still thank him every day. And then getting him in Chicago at the deadline, San Jose's casting him off, and we're just drooling, the coaches, the coaching staff. Like I was with Joel and Kitch in St. Louis when we had Michael Hanzus as a young player, and it killed us to trade him away for Keith Tkachuk. It just absolutely tore us apart, because we knew he was going to, what he brought, the intangibles that he brought. And then coming into our dressing room in Chicago was unbelievable. Just his presence. Yes, he slowed down. Yes, he was older, but he did everything right. He did everything right. He played with Patrick Kane. He had good enough hands. He was smart enough defensively, scored big goals, gave Patty the puck when he needed, played with Sharpie, killed penalties. He played on the power play. He was just, when he spoke in the dressing room, which wasn't very often, he let his actions on the ice be his leadership. And in the first game of the playoffs in Chicago, he broke his wrist. He had to get this bone in his wrist shot up before every game. He'd still go out and practice. No one said a word. No one, if they blocked a shot, no one was feeling sorry. They were getting up off the ice. If someone was hurt, they were getting up off the ice. There was no trainer coming off the ice, because they saw Michael Hanzus and they knew what he meant. And just to show what they meant, we won in Boston in a crazy finish. And usually the captain carries the cup off the plane. Well, Jonathan Toews didn't carry the cup off the plane. It was Michael Hanzus who carried the cup off the plane. And that says just a lot about the type of person that he is and the impact he had on our team.
Thank you, Comper. Metro, we'll go over to you. You mentioned already number 77, but you also had number 91, and you had number, 80?
Coach is 86. No, 91 was actually, he played 2 minutes in the whole playoffs. The way our guys ride around that, of course, Victor on the ice, he's the guy that, you know, jump on his back. And I'm sure you guys have those players too. Like, usually you need those role guys to win, but you don't win if your top guys aren't pulling their weight also. Yeah. So there was, I mean, I mentioned Pat Maroon when he came in, you know, early in the year, we had a tough start this year. Like we were 500 until we went to Sweden. And at one point, like Patty Maroon's the one that said, you know, F off with your, I feel sorry for myself. We lost in four last year. Like we weren't here. We don't give a shit. Excuse my language, but we don't care. Like him and Shattenkirk were great, great voices in the room that, even during the playoffs, you know, between overtimes, like Shaddy's one of the guys that stepped up a few times, and people don't necessarily think of that. They think, oh, offensive defenseman, that thinks about it. Far from it. And one last little piece that it might be tiny, but to us, it's funny. We said it's going to keep with us as we go forward the next few years, is Braden Coburn has almost 1,000 games in the NHL. Even Luke Shen has, 800-900 games. Very well-respected guys. They barely play in the playoffs, especially Braden Coburn, who when this team went to the Cup Finals 4 years ago, he was on the top four match against the top lines. Every single morning, every optional skate they were on, game six of the Stanley Cup Finals, you know, even Coop said after, coaches, go on 15 minutes, get off. There's no back skate. There's no... Braden Coburn and Luke Shen bagged themselves for 35 minutes after everybody was off the ice. I just happened to walk by in Edmonton, you know, they have the practice rink connected to the main rink. I walk by and I see those two guys, like it's game six, whether you bag yourself or not, if we lose, we play game seven. Like it's little things like that. Guys saw that. Like you have a guy that has almost 1,000 games in the NHL. He's not even playing and he's still bagging himself to make sure he's ready in case he's called upon for game seven. You know, I'm not saying that's what made the whole difference, but it's little things like that sometimes that send a message to the rest of the team. And that I was impressed. And Of course they wanted to play, but they made sure they stayed ready.
Yeah, it's a brick, another brick in the wall. Exactly. Mike, what about you? GOAT, captain's class?
Well, I love those stories. I love those stories, and I love to listen to the guys tell those stories. I think in each group, I just talked about Dallas Drake, but in order to have success and for your team to win a championship, your best players got to be the best people and got to work the hardest. And when you got a superhuman being, a seven-time Norris Trophy winner and Nick Lidstrom, who does it every night, and he embraces the monotony of the game. He doesn't get bored with it. He tapes his stick perfect. He puts his equipment on perfect. He practices harder than anybody else. He just does it right. When he makes a mistake, there's no bad body language. He comes back, he takes a drink of water. Datsyuk stays on the ice longer than anybody after practice and plays one-on-one. Every kid that comes up's got a battle against Pav. Zetterberg plays without the puck, stops on defense, does it right, communicates with the players. You need all those guys to be the best they can be. I thought in Tampa this year, Cooch took care of the puck. Tampa stopped on defense. They did it right. When a guy like Dallas Drake comes to your team and he's been through the grind for a long time and he's come to you because he wants to win the cup. He's a Michigan guy there, living in Northern Michigan, and he's willing to do it right every day. He's willing to go through the wall at 37 years old or whatever he is to run over people, to play injured all the time. It's a direct message to everybody else on what's acceptable. The coach can talk all he wants. You need those veteran leaders that do it right and do it for the team, and they set the tone. And it's not what they say, it's what they do.
Can I give, again, just jump in a second? And I know, listen, Jamie, I'm sure we can talk about Jonathan Toews all we want, the leadership. But I remember also, Babs, I don't know if it was I heard you at a convention or something, or maybe a McGill alumni thing, or it was Marty Raymond that told me that you said that to coach the Detroit Red Wings, to have the guys play the right way when your two best players, Zetterberg and Datsyuk, play the right way on both sides of the ice. It makes it easy for the rest of the team to follow. And I'm sure Jamie's the same thing with you with a guy like Toews. They play the right way. And then when it's your top players, because, yeah, your third, fourth line guys will play the right way. That's how they stay in the league. That's how they're effective. And when those guys, and I remember, I think Babs, it was you mentioning it, that Zetterberg and Datsyuk were your hardest workers, your better defensive players, and they were your best offensive players. So everybody has to follow suit.
Oh, well, yeah. That's, you know what? Sorry, Ken. Patrick. Kane, that was the one thing coming into Chicago. Joel said, he goes, you know, Kaner, we just got to make sure that he's doing the right thing. And I think there was a lot to prove. They'd won the cup in 10, lost in the first round the previous 2 years, and they had something to prove. And Kaner came into camp, and that was the 48-game season, the strike-shortened season. I don't have to remind you, but we went to 21-0-3 to start the season that year. And everyone was doing it right. And you're right, Matthew. We had Hosts and we had Toews. Two hardest working guys. Kaner, he worked his tail off because your best players, there's a reason why they're your best players. They want to get better. They want to be coached. They want to be the best players. They want to stay on top. They want those details. They want that extra help. If it means passing pucks or rimming pucks to them or doing the little things after practice to help them out, they want that because that's what makes them the best. They stay on top of those habits and details. It was a pleasure to coach that team, boy. That was a lot of fun.
Expectations come in there, both from the players at various levels, from expectations of playing and expectations of winning. But you also have the other side of it because you're in the middle of that organization. You've got the expectations of not just ownership, but also upper management. What's the toughest situation have you ever found yourself in with respect to managing those expectations, coaching those expectations, either up or?
Expectations. Well, listen, I can't speak about this team the last 5-6 years being a contender, not coming through, but I know, like, when I came in, they had 62 wins a year before. So expectation is, it didn't matter what we did in the regular season. It didn't matter what we did in the first round, second round. We had to win the cup or get to the finals to make sure that it was worth it. Because, you know, like, your core is there, it's signed, the salary cap is an issue. It's even more of an issue now because of COVID, unfortunately, that nobody predicted, but we knew we'd be in a situation. So the expectation of winning, and that's what I've been very impressed with Julian, the way he's done. Like, let's face it, you need a good owner to be able to do the proper things. Mr. Vinnick is an unbelievable owner, and he told Julian, you do what you have to get this team to the next level. And Julian wasn't afraid, like, a lot of people would have said, oh, you should fire the coach. I mean, he's like, why should I get rid of John Cooper when I'll be looking for the next John Cooper? You know, so he stood by his coach, and Julian's the one that hired him in Norfolk in the AHL. So he stood by the coach, made the adjustment that we felt, and we're all part of it. But at the end of the day, like Julian, when he was nominated for GM of the year, he keep telling us, and myself and Jamie Pusher, Stacey Roos, there's three guys that were mostly with him. All right, guys, you're, you know, it's you guys too. Yeah, it is, Julian. But at the end of the day, you're the one pulling the trigger. If it doesn't work, nobody's saying, oh, Matthew Darcy. They're still going to say Julian Breezeball. I think with the expectation that he had now, making those two moves at the deadline for first-round picks, you know, a lot of people are going to say, you're getting a first-round pick for Barkley Goodrow, who's a 25, 30-point guy. But like we said at the start, we don't win with those guys. So the expectation, which I was winning because of the way the makeup of the team, and to Julian as a second-year GM, not being afraid to pull the trigger and stand by his coach and say, we needed to change this on the team. Here are the players. Let's do it. And it works. So to me, that was the impressive part this year.
Thank you. Over to Mike.
Well, you know, just expectation. And expectation's a wonderful thing. You know, when you go to the Olympic Games and you're expected, your country's expected to finish last, there's no expectations, but there's no chance to win either. So isn't life all about expectations and setting as high as you possibly can? I'm just going to change direction a little bit here. The most expectation I ever felt in my life, and, you know, I didn't know it till just before, was in 2010 Olympics. I coached in Detroit. We spent the whole year in Detroit. You get on a plane, you go to Canada, you land in Canada. You've done all the work. You've done all the process. You got all the coaches. You know all that. But when I hit the ground in Vancouver, that's when I knew what expectation was. And a whole new level of something I never, ever felt in my whole life. I've told this story a bunch of times. You know, Yzerman was a manager. We had unbelievable management team, coaching staff, trainers, everything, players. U.S. played before us game one of the Olympics. You're sitting there watching them. You're done all your work. You go up, you sit in the crowd. I can remember my legs started to shake. I stopped them. I said, hey, smarten up. They kept shaking. I went down the dressing room where I was comfortable. And 2 days later, after we won, we're getting ready to play again. We've done all our work, go up and sit, and the U.S. is playing again. I forget who they're playing. My legs started to shake. That was the last time I went up. It was a total different level of expectation being in Canada, expected to win than I ever experienced before. Don't get me wrong. We won 58 games my first year in Detroit. We lost in the first round to Edmonton. We won a ton of games. We won 50 plus games 4 years in a row. My second year, we lost in the final four. We turned the puck over at the red line when we were leaving or winning, lost the game in overtime. I'll never forget it. Ended up not winning the cup. The next year, you got to win the cup. You're going to be moving your family again. That's part of it. But also, you have the opportunity. It's not about the downside. It's about the upside. Expectations simply mean you have a chance. That's what you want in life. You want a chance. You want to build the best opportunity to give yourself and your players the chance to have success. In the end, when we were little kids playing road hockey, Leaf Rapids, Manitoba, used to put the candlesticks on a calm night in the snow piles on the road, and all you wanted to do was lift the cup at the end of your road hockey game as a little kid. To actually get to do it, to dreaming with your eyes open, in my opinion, is visualizing. That's what a dream's about. Your eyes are open. You see yourself doing it, and then you get to do it. Nothing better. Expectations are all part of that in managing them. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mike. Over to Jamie.
I agree with Babs. I think that's the biggest thing is you go into this job. You're in this. I don't consider it a job. I don't consider what I do a job. It's a passion. I love what I do. I jump out of bed every morning. I'm excited about going to work. I'm excited about the opportunity that lies in front of me. I don't think about the downside. I don't think about, oh yeah, if we don't win tonight, what could happen? That's not part of the vocabulary. We're problem solvers. We're solution makers. We got to get everybody feeling good about where we're at and where we're going to and where we're going to get to, whether it's our young players, our veteran players, the other coaches. It's bringing that attitude that we've got this opportunity, like Bob said, we've got this opportunity to do something that, you know, not very many people get an opportunity to do. And so, yeah, there's expectations that come with it, but there's expectations that come with everything. And I'd rather do this than anything else in the world. Like, how many people are fortunate? How many people in the world love what they do? We absolutely love what they do. jump out of bed and say, I love what I'm doing today. I'm excited about going to work. I don't know. I don't know the percentage, but I can't see it being very high. And we're very fortunate to have that. So you got to make the most out of every opportunity you have. Every time you're at the rink, every time you step on the ice, you got to bring that. That's the way I feel. I feel that every day. I live it every day. And whatever I do, that's my attitude. And that's the way I choose to live it. And if I can portray that on our players to get them in the right frame of mind, to get them feeling good, the chances are that for us to be successful that night is going to be good. And then we get that, like I talked about earlier, that snowball effect, and everyone gets feeling good about themselves. And then the sky's the limit.
Excellent stuff. Thank you very much.
Comper, you couldn't have said it any better. If you're a young person out there, if you're a McGill player and you're in the process of educating yourself, you're looking for a career, the number one question you should be asking yourself is, what do you love to do? Now, we all got to feed our family. But what I found in life, when you're passionate about something, you're going to be really good at it. And if you're not passionate, you're not going to be that good at it. But I can tell you, Kenny, since I met you and I left McGill, all I've ever done is hockey. Now, I have an unbelievable family and I have tons of hobbies and I have a great life away from hockey. But this has been the biggest scam of all time. And in some ways, is someone pays you to coach hockey for a living. You'd be doing this anyway if you had another job. You'd have the job and you'd be working on your seven-year-old team all day, getting ready for the practice at night. We've got to do this every day and do something we love to do and share our passion with a bunch of young people. If you're at McGill and you're building a foundation for success of an education, which you need, it's so important to ask yourself, what do I love to do? And you're probably going to have 10 or 11 different jobs anyway, and you're going to change your career a couple of times. But in reality, if you can love doing what you're doing, you're going to be good at it. And the people around you are going to appreciate it because you're going to enjoy doing what you do, and you're going to live a good life because of it. So I thought what Comper had to say was spot on.
Thank you. Let's go right back to you, Jamie.
I just think that you chase your dreams, you chase your passions. And like Mike said, I haven't worked a day in my life. Like I left McGill. I went back to McGill and coached there and taught for 5 years. And then I said, there's something more for me out there. I took a leap of faith. I trusted myself. I believed in myself. That's the biggest thing, is my belief in myself. And people saw something in me, and I'm very fortunate that people saw something in me. And to this day, I'm so grateful to Joel Quenneville for giving me, and Larry Plough for giving me an opportunity to get my foot in the NHL, in the door in the NHL. And then from there, it's what you do with it. And that's the biggest thing, is how hard you want to work and how much do you want to learn and how proactive can you be? And as an assistant coach, for me, my job is to make the head coach's job as easy as possible. I'm trying to be 1, 2, 3 steps ahead of him so that he doesn't have to worry about things. He has to worry about what he needs to worry about that day, whether it's talking to the team, whether it's preparing the team, whether it's sending a message to the team, whatever it is, talking to individuals. My job is everything else besides that. That's our job, is to make his job the easiest job possible. And I embrace that role and I love what I do. And I can't see myself doing anything else. And there's no one that's going to take this job away from me because of the fact that I don't work hard enough or I don't prepare hard enough. That's for sure.
Thank you, Jamie. Straight from the heart. Maddie.
Well, same for me. For 12 years, I never thought somebody was paying me to play hockey, never mind working hockey, but I was playing a game and I was getting paid. And when I retired, I went in the business world. And, you know, Babs and Comper talked about the passion. Is I had a great job in Montreal, very stable, great company. I got this opportunity. I didn't do it for the money because financially it was a lateral move, if not even a little step down. But to get back in hockey was, my brother-in-law said it best. When I took the job, he's like, oh, it's awesome. It's like playing fantasy hockey, but for real. You know, you're building your team. And so it's, you know what? I think in my position, having my degree and from McGill on top of it, and I bugged Julian because his undergrad is from Concordia. So I said, I was the second choice. So But even my and my son's applying to McGill right now, and he wants to go back to Montreal. Just to link with McGill, you know, just to if I link it to McGill, like my wife, I met my wife at McGill. My son, we moved, so he was a junior in high school. Now he's a senior. He's applying to college. He wants to go back to McGill, and obviously it's tough to get into McGill now. So I tease Julian. His plan B is Concordia, and just to tease him a bit. So and. The link you have with McGill too, and it's funny because I didn't meet Jamie very often, but I know Mike. I met him once when I was in Syracuse. He was coaching in Cincinnati, and when I retired, I still remember that I get a phone call from a number from Michigan, and I'd never talked to Baz besides shaking his hand. And I get a number from Michigan calling me. I was wondering who is it from Michigan, and it was Babs calling me just to congratulate me on my career when I retired, which I thought, you know, like the nice link from McGill was outstanding. And in this job, there's a former player right now that's going to go work for a team. He called me and asked me, you know, because I just did the switch, and he's going to touch a bit everything. And I told him, you know what, as to what Comper said is, you'll get as much out of it as you put in. If you go in thinking you're just going to, the job is sitting around shooting the shit with the GM and talking about the team, just giving your opinion, you got to be there for, you're going to do the same thing and you won't progress. Whatever work you put in is what you get out of it. Like Comper to get where he was, you know, he got his foot in and then he worked and he got more and more. And same thing with Babs, you know, and first of all, Babs, everybody keeps telling me, oh, did Babcock coach with McGill? No, he never coached at McGill. People still don't know that. So Mike came in and he coached in Cincinnati, went to Anaheim and Detroit. And then because he worked hard, he had success. He was able to coach Team Canada. So all these things is you get out of it as much as you put in my opinion.
Excellent. Well, we've had a young man who does coach McGill, although if you ask him how his experience has been, maybe that's what you will do. He's had a very difficult time of it. His first year coming in to taking over the head coaching and now wanting to start a season up and they're taking it away from him. We had a great conversation on this podcast to kick the whole season off. I'm delighted to have you here, Liam. And now we have a chance to ask Liam the questions you got for him as a young man taking over the McGill Redmond hockey program.
Well, Liam, what's the biggest challenge right now to keep the guys engaged and keep the guys developing? Because I know there's no games. Are you guys practicing? Like, what's the biggest challenge right now?
Great question, Bershy. I think the biggest challenge right now is, well, the biggest challenge is keeping our guys motivated. I think the toughest piece of adversity with that is that we don't have access as a team at this moment to be on the ice as a group. So at a time like this, it'd be great to have an opportunity, even in small groups, to work together in person. So unfortunately, we're not able to do that. So we've tried to break things down in instances where we're working with our leadership group over Zoom and then our first year student athletes as well. And one of the directions that we're working on is shifting our focus towards academics right now and making sure we're doing a great job in the classroom.
Nice. Thank you. Comper?
Yeah, well, I know that I've gone out and helped. Yeah, here I go. My allegiance here to McGill. But because I'm in Manitoba right now, I'm friends with the University of Manitoba's coach. So they've had they've offered me to come out a few times. So I've been out helping them. And they're in, like you said, small groups right now. And now we're in Code Red. We hit Code Red Friday because of the spikes in Manitoba here. So everything's shut down for the next 2 weeks. They started off in those small pods. I think they're allowed to have 13 guys on the ice, 13 or 12 or 13 guys on the ice. So that's how we addressed it. We had forwards and D, and then we did half forwards and half the D on one session, half the forwards, half the D on the other session. But for you, has there been much contact in terms of getting the team together via, like you talk about Zoom, like Zoom calls like this and utilizing your connections, getting possibly getting Matthew or Babs or myself on the call with the players to talk about maybe their experiences or something that they maybe some input or just to shoot the breeze like we're doing right now. Is there an opportunity maybe to do that?
Absolutely. Jamie, that's a great idea. And along the lines of something that we've been trying to work on, I've sent some messages to Mike Nelson, the president of FMH, and I'd really like to get an FMH sort of panel discussion going for our guys to learn from our alumni in small groups. So that's something that's actually hopefully in the works and something we can put together here in the next month.
Well, that's perfect. Perfect. That's good to hear.
And we'd love to have you guys out to meet the boys and share some stories as well.
Liam, I'm with Comper here. As I think you got lots of resources out there. Darsher's just one. He'd be a great guy to talk to your guys. What he's gone through is current. The messages that you and him can talk about prior to a call would be spectacular. I'm right now talking about McGill connections. I'm at the University of Vermont. Woody, Todd Woodcroft went to McGill as well, playing the JV program. I'm here helping his guys. I come a week a month. The reality is you want to use all the resources you can to maximize your group. And your guy through McGill hockey has a lot of connections without any question. Our alumni is spectacular there. I was saying the guys, I'm still tight with the guys from my class. Earl Zuckerman's done a good job of keeping us all together and keeping us informed, but there's lots of avenues for you out that way, and you want to take advantage of it for sure. These guys that have offered, I mean, would be great help to you, and I'm sure the guys would enjoy talking to guys that have been at McGill and love McGill as much as these guys do.
Absolutely, and I think that's something that separates our program away from the others across the country is our alumni and where they are right now and the stories that they can share with our group of current players.
There you go.
Or anytime you need us, we're available, awesome. Liam.
They set the table, Liam. Time to serve.
Amazing.
Liam, any last comments or questions for any of the guys here?
I'd just like to thank you guys so much. I've learned a ton in a short amount of time from listening to your stories today. So thank you for sharing. If I could ask one question myself, it would be, what was one small piece of advice or guidance that you guys had as young coaches that stuck particularly out to you that you maybe carry on with you now, or a key mentor in your young coaching career that you learned from, and something in particular that they gave to you?
A key piece of advice from a key mentor. Any thoughts?
Well, I'll just jump in here, guys. To me, having a growth mindset, embracing lifelong learning, understanding that you got to get better each and every day. That's what you challenge your players to do. You got to do the same. The resources we just talked about, I think, are so important for you. But I think in this time, you know, especially at the COVID time, that you can really help your players by helping yourself. And what I mean by that is continuing to grow. They want to see new. They want to see best. They want to be a cutting edge when they get to the rink. In order for them to get that, you want to be looking after that. And then instead of talking about it, you can show it. And I think that modeling is so key. So I've had so many guys help me along the way, to say the least, not even funny, but to me, it's that growth mindset. It's that understand you got to get better each and every day to have success. What allows you to do it for a long time and help your teams help themselves.
I agree with Babs, Liam. I think the big thing is that when we played back in the day, I think it was more of a dictatorship. You jump, you run, you skate as hard as you can. You do what the coach tells you to do. And now it's a partnership. It is a partnership with your players. So it's those connections. It's what they need. And, you know, it's funny. Paul and I talk about it every day. You know, in today's game, it's the players that we joke about is how many touches they can get on the ice. What are their touches? How many touches they can get on the ice? And the more touches they get, the more confident they get. The more confident they get, the more ice time they get. The more ice time they get, the more points they get. And then guess what? At the NHL level, when all that comes together, this is where it comes to your problem here, Darcy, is that they get paid. They finally get paid, right? So the more touches they get, that's what they want. So trying to get that partnership where you're satisfying not only the players, but yourself at the same time, and that growth between you, that partnership between you and the players, and connecting those dots. I think that's really important. And then growing with your players every day, you know, obviously you're going to have success with that because they're going to start believing in what they're doing. They're feeling good about themselves. You're getting them to buy into what you're selling. And then you're halfway home by that point.
Good stuff. Thanks, Darcy.
You know, Liam, those two guys are so right. The growth mindset, like, when we draft, we have our sports psychologist, actually, that you might know, Dr. Ryan Hamilton from UNB, who works with Hockey Canada also. And obviously, it's not an exact science to find out, but part of his questionnaire is finding kids that have a growth mindset. That's like one of the things in our organization that brought us success. We want to draft players with growth mindsets. Is it black and white that you can say, oh, this guy has one and this guy doesn't? Not really, but there's some things you can kind of gear you to. This guy most likely has it. that's the biggest thing we're trying to do in our organization to bring players, because let's face it, you're not a finished product when you draft a player at 18. Just like when you're coaching a guy, the guy comes in as a freshman and the guy that finishes after 4 or 5 years, he's not the same player. You want him to have the mentality to progress. And if I can relate to a personal experience and about a mentor, like Marty Ramo and Guy Boucher had a big influence on my career. Like Marty coached me 4 years at McGill. I had one assist my first year. That's it. I played football two, one assist. Second year, Guy was Marty's assistant. He worked with me after practice. And then they coached me in Hamilton. I was a 30-year-old back in the minors after being in Tampa. And I remember at the end of the year, I had a meeting with the coaches and, you know, everybody had a meeting. All right, what do you see your role? I said, Guy, I know I'm here to help the young guys. You know, like I was 30 years old as a good AHL player. And Guy's the one that stopped me straight and said, Darcy, that's bullshit. I was like, whoa, what do you mean? He said, yeah, it's part of your role, but doesn't mean you're not trying to get to the NHL and get better and you get back to the NHL too. And it was a kind of a kick in the ass I needed at that point in my career. And I finished playing 3 years with the Montreal Canadiens after. So sometimes, you know, you just need that, because I always felt I had a growth mindset. But after a while, when you're always, you know, I spent a lot of times in the AHL, you start almost, I don't want to say complacent, you're like, all right, that's my role. And I needed somebody to kick me and say, you know what, you too, you want to get back to the NHL. So to me, that's one person that had an impact on my career. Guy and Marty, they were together. It was just reverse role in Hamilton. Guy was the head coach and Marty was the assistant.
That's a great way to, thank you very much, guys. That's a great way to end it too. This has been an absolute privilege and honor to bring you guys all back together into one group here that we can share this kind of experience that you've had in life, in hockey, and then share it because you're all part of a hockey program that we all dearly love and are strongly connected to. So thank you so much for being so willing to hop on and to share the way you're sharing. I'd love to do this every week, but I know that I know that it's a special event and we haven't done it for an awful long time. So it's so good that we got it rolling this time around. The podcast will go. I'll do one a month over the wintertime, and I think it'll help replace the hockey we're not going to get. But more than that, I think it'll help bring us all back together and reconnect again. And that's just absolutely a brilliant part of the life I'd like to lead.
Yeah, I just want to say thanks. That's all I want to say. Thanks. And, you know, when I look back at McGill, lots of the great things in my life have happened because of McGill. So thank you.
And you see, for us, we still have the growth mindset. I love listening from guys like Comper and Babs. They've had success. So we each share different experiences. So it's always interesting to hear these things.
Keep learning. Learn every day. Never too old to stop learning. And that's what's the great thing about this. And I want to thank you for taking the time to listen today. And thanks for letting me be a part
of it. Okay, great stuff, guys. Awesome. Thank you. And we like to finish with our line, keep your elbows up and your sticks on the ice. So I wish you well. Take good care. Don't be strangers.
Thank you.
I'd love to be able to be in touch with you as you go along in life and get your updates.
Well, that concludes the captain's meeting for November 2020. Thanks for listening. We're already looking forward to our next podcast in December when we bring you more delightful conversations with our captains as they share their life experiences and insights from the McGill years and beyond. This is Ken Tyler signing off. Looking forward to seeing you next time. And in between, until then, keep your elbows up and your stick on the ice.